The Guardian.
Welcome to another Film Weekly from The Observer. I'm Jason Solomons, and on the show this week, I meet French director François Ozon to find out about his first UK film, Angel.
Each time I try to provoke or to give a surprise. There are some audience who like to be surprised, and some others want to see always the same thing. In my case, it's more dangerous to see a film of François Ozon, maybe.
Yes, Angel's a film full of curiosities and surprises, and more of that later. We'll be hearing from the Venice Film Festival as Guardian film editor Andrew Pulver navigates the canals of that wondrous city in search of movie gold. And Zan Brooks will be joining me in the studio to review the week's other releases, including Step Brothers, a reissue of Terrence Malick's classic Badlands, and Babylon AD. But first... Let us go then, you and I, to the hip-hop summer of 1994, to the steamy streets of New York, where a teenage weed dealer meets a wacky shrink played by Sir Ben Kingsley.
Do you have any idea what I would give to be you again? Not you specifically, but me at your age? Doesn't get any better. Get your heart broken, find yourself face down in the gutter, get your pulse up, make a real mess of your life, son.
This is what you tell all your patients.
You're not depressed, Luke. You're sad. There's a difference.
No, I'm depressed. I'm mad depressed, yo. So just give me some of those happy pills. We can call it a day.
The film is The Whackness, and I went down to its London premiere last week to meet its young director, Jonathan Levine, and to find out just how autobiographical it all was.
I put more of myself into this than I think a lot of people do. I mean, it's not autobiographical strictly, because I never had a character like Sir Ben in my life. I never sold pot, you know. No. I certainly had the numbers of a lot of guys who did. But I, you know, it's very personal though. You know, the music, the world, the relationship stuff. It's all very personal. It's just not, none of that shit ever happened to me.
And this is exactly why the film works for me. You know, as a Londoner growing up in that time, but that music was my music. That summer, we still managed to have a hot summer occasionally. You wouldn't believe it tonight, of course.
I don't know.
But I mean, that did you preserve that as a memory when you're writing and making a film like that? Because you kind of recreate that time, but it's a time that's kind of disappeared as your film makes out.
You know, it's for me, it was about thinking back to that time and putting myself in the headspace of that person. A big part of that was being, you know, remembering where I was at when I was listening to Biggie, when I was listening to Nas.
And I think it's very interesting when you're a writer and a director that the more specific you make a film, the more absolutely kind of tied down in a locus, in a place, in a time, the more resonant it is to a more general time. It's funny.
That's funny that you said that, because that was exactly what we were going for. Is that, you know, the more specific you can be, the more universal you can be, and. You know, what we want for this movie, what we hope for this movie, is not that people, like I said, have specific memories of 1994. 1994 is fairly arbitrary. You know, for me, it was a big year, but it doesn't have to be for an audience. What has to be big is, you know, identifying with our characters and their struggles and their emotions and their foibles. And so I think you can do that by being authentic, because when you're authentic, you're true, you know, and like truth, hopefully, kind of connects in a way.
I think so, and you get wonderful performances out of Sir Ben Kingsley, wonderful performance out of your lead.
You don't have to try very hard to get a good performance out of Sir Ben Kingsley.
Well, yeah, just talk us through. I mean, how you, because the guy, you know, a bit of a legend, but he's doing a lot of films at the moment, very different parts. Yeah. How did you actually secure him, and what was he like? Did you rehearse with him, or did he just arrive on set with this character?
I didn't. I mean, he probably would have, but I never asked. I think, you know, I just assumed he would be awesome from day one, and he was. I mean, he rewarded my faith. But I think the way we got him was we had financing in place, and we were able to get the script to him just simply because there were a lot of people around town who were getting behind it, because it spoke to, I think, a generation that isn't always spoken to in independent film. And so they got it to him. And he read it very quickly, because he's a voracious reader.
He's a speed reader.
He reads very quickly. But he's very passionate, you know, and he's very much, and you can see it in his work, and you can certainly see it in this movie that he's having the time of his life. And so he read it, he responded to it, and I went to Vancouver where he was working on Elegy, which is another amazing performance.
It was out last week in the UK.
Yeah, it just came out, and I talked to him, and we got on quite well. And then, you know, the next day or a couple days later, I found out he was doing it. And I was so, so happy.
Wow.
I mean, is the character written? I haven't seen the script, Jonathan. Is the character written as it is? Or did Ben Kingsley come and say, I'm Sir Ben, I'm going to do it this way with this accent, with this hair, with this moustache?
I mean, yes, he had a very specific idea about how he wanted to look and how he wanted to carry himself. And if you watch his films, that is very much how he accesses the characters, through posture and through, you know. But at the same time, I asked him, I said, you know, is there anything in the script you don't like? Is there anything you want me to change? And he said, no, I love it. You know, even when he got a single word wrong in a take, he would ask the script supervisor to come up to him and tell him, because he adhered to the text that closely. And that's where he draws his conclusions about a character from, is just reading it. He's very classically trained, very Shakespearean, and that's how he does it. Mm-hmm. Even with someone who's taking bong hits and hooking up with Mary-Kate Olsen, he still does it that way, and that's why he's amazing.
What I did also love about the movie, obviously, was the use of hip-hop and music in 94, which is an era for which I've not seen nostalgia yet on the big screen.
No.
Are you the first 90s movie?
There's a movie called Definitely Maybe. Have you seen that?
Yes, we have. Yeah,
that movie's pretty good.
With Ryan Reynolds?
Ryan Reynolds, yeah. Anyway, they did in the 90s. I didn't know about that when we were making ours. But I think we are one of the first. And so, you know, we were very... It was a lot of fun to pull references and to think about what it was like to be in that era. And to sort of create... kind of cherry pick our own nostalgia moments.
Yeah, because I don't think people define that decade yet. The strange thing is we're nearly at the end of this decade, but we still haven't kind of worked out what the 90s was all about.
No, and I don't think it will be for a few years. It seems to make people feel old to start thinking of it that way. Yeah. But for me, it was really fun to think of it that way, because it is so much a part of my coming of age, my growing up. And I think that it's always very interesting to look at an era where you're like, oh, that was, there's nothing, I can't define that. It was just normal. It was like today, you know? Yeah. And there'll be 20 years from now, someone will make a movie about us and what we're wearing and how our hair is cut. And, you know, it's really interesting, because every time and place is so specific.
But those details are crucial. I mean, you open on an Adidas shell toe and you're like, that's my era.
Yeah, totally, man. And even that kid is wearing a shell toe as nostalgia for him.
Exactly.
You know, that the shell toe came out in the 80s, and he's like, you know, it's an interesting play on pop culture as well, and sort of the impact of pop culture and the various kind of ways we define ourselves through it. That's kind of a subtle thing. I don't know. I just learned that about the movie myself watching it.
It was interesting to see, for me, as a nice Jewish boy, talking to another nice Jewish boy, that kind of obsession.
I'm not so nice.
You're not so nice?
You don't seem that nice either.
I'm maybe not so Jewish, maybe. But between us, we'll make a nice Jewish boy.
Okay, one nice Jewish boy between two people.
Is the love for hip-hop, which I think is extraordinary. I mean, all of those tunes, The Far Side, De La Soul, The Tribe Called Quest, I saw them all in New York myself in that period in concert.
Great,
I mean, but to see them on the screen is great homage to that, and that kind of obsession with the Jewish boy kind of growing up as a kind of black kid.
Yeah, there's something specific about the Jewish... I mean, it's a white kid's love of hip-hop, but it's also, I think I know a lot of Jews who really have it more than just anyone else. They just feel a connection to it, and I think, but you know, I think hip-hop is about, it's kind of the music of revolution, it's the music of the disenfranchised, and anyone can feel disenfranchised, you know.
And what about you, Jonathan? I know this has had some decent success. All the boys love Mandy Lane too. People are tipping you very, very highly as a great new hotshot young director, so I thought I'd get you while you're young, get you while you're here. What's coming up? What doors has the whackness opened for you?
You know, it's opened up a lot of doors. It's given me a lot of options. It's you know, I'm so proud of the film that it becomes that much more difficult to make that decision. And thus far, what I'm doing is I'm actually writing, adapting a script for a big studio in the States, and adapting a book.
Can you tell me which one?
It's a spy novel called Echelon Vendetta. It's a wonderful book, and I think the script's going to be great.
Congratulations.
Enjoy.
Jonathan Levine there, and The Whackness is on general release across the UK from Friday, August the 29th. And as music plays such a key role in The Whackness, we've got the original soundtrack of the film up for grabs in our fabulous Film Weekly competition. Three copies of it, featuring Big E, Fresh Prince, KRS-One, R. Kelly, and The Tribe Called Quest. To win, just tell me, what does The Whackness actually mean? Mark your answers for The Whackness competition and send them to film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. That's film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. And we must have your answers for this one by the 2nd of September. Fresh. A rhythm recipe that you savor. Doesn't matter if you're minor or major. Yes, I'm delighted to welcome Zan Brooks, roving Guardian reporter and film critic, into the pod studio with me. Zan, our first film this week is Babylon AD, directed by former French bad boy Mathieu Kassovitz.
I mean, this is a big kind of slam-bang, apocalyptic, cyberpunk adventure movie.
Oh, one of them?
Yeah. And yet, I kind of sneakily like this.
Do you? I mean, do you like... I mean, it's based on a comic strip Edition Gallimard, so clearly one of those French comic strips that kind of is an homage to American sci-fi and always got kung fu in it and a bit of karate and shooting and a bit of parkour, I noticed, that free-running thing where people jump off buildings a lot, which seems to be a must or a must.
I don't like any of that, Jason. All that annoys me. What I do like is Vin Diesel. I find him kind of a wonderfully shambolic action hero. He reads his lines as if he's just kind of looking through them at the read through and sort of mumbling them. He looks sort of vaguely irritated and slightly like he doesn't know quite what's going on,
yeah.
As if he sort of signed up for an altogether different movie. Like, you know, they said, Vin, come and do a refined costume drama, and then he's looking around and thinking, Jesus, there's all these cyberpunks attacking me. What am I supposed to do? Somebody sold me a pup here,
including Gérard Depardieu.
Gérard Depardieu, like. Gérard Depardieu playing the kind of the crime kingpin in a sort of white suit and jet black hair, and looks like some sort of Demis Roussos.
Doesn't
kind of
he?
It's very creepy.
I mean, it's extraordinary. And then there's some very extraordinary, beautiful French bird who they've kind of got off the cover of.
Yeah, but she's a sensitive convent girl and holy virgin, and yet she's also, you know, in typical tradition, she's also very foxy and you know, makes a move on Vin at one stage.
Yeah, and Michelle Yeoh is in this as well, not doing kung fu, and kind of going against...
She does a little bit of kung fu. It's in the contract.
And Charlotte Rampling, of course.
And Charlotte Rampling in her second film of the week.
Yes. And so Babylon, you quite liked it. I mean, it's 90 minutes, it's loud, it's noisy, in a way. It has a skidoo chase in it as well, which I haven't seen.
So many chases. And then it just kind of ends, and you think, did that actually resolve anything? And of course it didn't.
No, there's no reason for it. Is she dead? Is she alive?
Just
is there a
film.
Sequel? And no, Mathieu Kassovitz went. I mean, there was a similarity to let in because there's this kind of desert kind of scape of Russia, which is kind of all lawless. And I thought, well, maybe that is why he's attracted to this.
Possibly. It sort of supposedly pays lip service to the sort of, the world that we're all heading to, the sort of apocalyptic world where there's sort of refugee crises and things like that. And yet, you know, it's basically just an excuse for Vin Diesel to kind of punch people.
Yeah. Exactly, and take his vest off.
Yeah.
It's that bit you liked, isn't it?
He's a hottie.
Let's move on to Step Brothers, which features Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly together again after Talladega Nights and Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. Now, John C. Reilly, here they play two brothers who... No, here they play two 40-year-olds arrested in development who have not left home yet when their parents suddenly get together, Mary Steenburgen and Richard Jenkins, he of The Visitor, and they're suddenly playing the roles of stepbrothers and have to live in each other's houses.
Suppose Nancy sees me coming out of the shower and decides to come on to me. I'm looking good. Got a luscious V of hair going from my chest pubes down to my ball fro. She takes one look at me and she goes, oh my God, I've had the old bull, now I want the young calf. And she grabs me by the wiener.
Shut the fuck up!
Zan, Will Ferrell, always silly. John C. Reilly, who used to be one of the great character actors of American cinema, he's fallen amongst thieves.
He has a bit, hasn't he? It's strange. I mean, you know, he was, you know, part of the Paul Thomas Anderson stable,
yeah.
And yeah, one of the great character actors of the late 90s.
People with middle, like William H. Macy, Paul Thomas Anderson,
yeah.
And John C. Reilly, they all kind of were great white hopes.
But maybe there's more money in playing a kind of comic buffoon than playing a troubled character actor who's sort of sixth billed in a great film.
Yeah, is he any good as the comic buffoon?
He's okay, but he's slightly out of his comfort zone with this, I think. And particularly if you know his great work, to kind of contrast it with this.
Ferrell, though, this is what you expect from Will Ferrell.
It's totally what you expect from Ferrell, and it's totally what you expect from Judd Apatow, who's the producer of this film. It's another comedy about American juveniles. Juveniles, you know, mentally and spiritually, if not physically. This is his stock in trade. This is sort of what he does. He makes films about sort of American boy men, Arrested Development kids, basically. This isn't as good as many of the others. It's not as good as Knocked Up. It's not as good as The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Superbad.
I like Superbad a lot. Too. I thought Superbad was fantastic.
I mean, I laughed quite a bit in Step Brothers, guiltily, mm-hmm. Sniggering at the back there. Share it with the rest of the class, Solomons, if it's so funny. And I did think it was quite amusing. It makes no sense. I mean, obviously, there's no comic logic to it. It isn't like, as you say, Knocked Up, which has a kind of story that you follow. This doesn't. I mean, it is basically there's a very long fart gag in it. There's lots of kind of wearing T-shirts and falling and pratfalls and kind of insults and rudeness. But that did kind of work for me.
It has its moments, and there's, you know, never underestimate the appeal of sort of laughing at losers. these people you think, you know, but for a few turns in the road, that might be me, but thank God it's not.
You're not wearing a Life's a Beach t-shirt.
I'm not living at home with Mom. Although, you know, if things go badly, I could well be back
there.
I
mean, there were moments where I wasn't laughing, but I was taken by the kind of Freudian element here in American society. And yes. There is very much something running through it, and it's Apatow laid bare, and they sort of, there's a final bit where they actually kind of get beat up a load of kids who'd been previously bullying them. And I thought this was some kind of Judd Apatow howl from hell, sort of about the inner child.
There's definitely a kind of serious underpinning to Judd Apatow's comedies. I mean, you know, you can't get too serious about it because they're basically just kind of, you know, scatological, slapsticky sitcoms. And yet, part of the reason why he's successful is that he does identify a certain strain of American culture, which is basically the retarded child. It's a nation of failed men, basically, who are still basically boys.
Yeah, and many of whom are making films these days doing very well with it, with their Star Wars memorabilia.
These people make films, and then there's enough people like them to watch the films.
And then the people who commission films are like, they say, oh my God, you remember Get Smart? That was so funny when we were kids. Let's make the movie. So there is this infantilism at the heart of it.
Yeah, I mean, you compare
it to,
say, the John Hughes comedies of the 80s. They were teen comedies for a teen audience.
Zan, let's move on from Will and John C. into new territory, Angel here. Francois Ozon, French film director, who's given us Sitcom, and he's given us Under the Sand, he's given us Swimming Pool, he's given us Eight Women. He's actually one of my favourite film directors, even though I can't really say I love any of his films in particular. I like his body of work, and this is an interesting step for him because it's his first film in England, in the English language, and it's called Angel, starring Romola Garai.
One day, because of me, the name of Deborah will shine throughout the world with glory.
Angel's a good girl, really.
She still has no idea about reality.
I'm going to be a famous writer! Thank you so much.
I can't take her side as a writer. But I've come to admire the woman.
Miss Angel Deborah.
I'm sorry to say I wasn't acquainted with your work, Miss Deborah.
I've decided to have my portrait painted.
I don't paint portraits.
Not even mine.
Angel, Zan, does it do it for you?
No, I think it's... I totally agree with you. I think Ozon is an incredibly talented filmmaker. The film of his that I really like is Eight Women, which on paper I should hate. It's a sort of musical mystery fashion parade. And it's all the things that I would normally recoil from, and yet he does it absolutely brilliantly.
Starring Catherine Deneuve and Isabelle Huppert and
A-list and
Bayard and Le Doyen.
Yeah, it's absolutely great. This is, again, a neat trick. I'm not sure it's much more than a neat trick. It's basically a story about storytelling. It's Romola Garai as a sort of Barbara Cartland-esque writer of romances who basically reconfigures her own life as a romance and is basically kind of acting a role. So it's very hyper-real. It's deliberately artificial. You've got these kind of dodgy back projections when she goes on her honeymoon with the pyramids behind and, you know, Venice.
So you're smiling because that made me laugh.
Yeah, it's fun. And yet I'm not sure it's much more than that. I guess you could probably, you know, I could show this film to my aunt and she would like it as a sort of tacky Mills and Boone-esque TV movie and it would work for her on that level. And yet it's kind of coated with this irony and this distance. I feel a bit stupid watching these sort of films. I had the same problem with this film that I had with Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven, which is basically a kind of semi-serious pastiche of a Douglas Sirk melodrama. And yet it's still a kind of pastiche. So you kind of... it's a copy of a cliche, and you watch it and you think, yeah, I can see what you're doing here, but what more are you doing with this?
Yes.
And I thought that Angel was the same. It's a sort of one-trick pony.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with these exercices to steal that the French are quite fond of and the kind of kitschness of it. But I was attracted because I think that Romain Legare gives it a certain depth in there. There's a certain tragedy of this person whose dreams and realities don't quite mix. So that's why I felt actually pulled into the film, and it did really work for me. I mean, it's a curio, definitely. Mm. But her performance, which veers from brilliant to absolutely terrible.
Yeah, shrill.
At one point you think, what are you doing, girl? Yeah. And it's very stagey, but I think it's kind of, I always hesitate to call actors' performances brave because, you know, they're on set.
It is brave.
But this one is brave because she's young still.
Yes, exactly. And she's basically got to carry the whole film, but to carry it basically playing an artificial character. So that's a huge ask for a young actor. And, you know, she has to age through this film. She wears some very kind of strange garb towards the end where she looks like a sort of Ozzy Osbourne impersonator at some time.
Ozzy Clark, I was going to say. That's the difference between you and me.
She is very good in it. And Michael Fassbender is very good as the sort of the tortured artist who she shacks up with. It's a great conceit. It's a sort of a brilliant kind of game. But I'm not sure it kind of works as a film for me.
If you want to play along with that game, hang on in there, because we'll be talking to François Ozon later. I'll be talking to him, Zan, not you, because I like it. If you could reconfigure the letters in the word angel, you get the word triangle, if a little bit.
A little bit. It's
bad seg, but I'm going to use it because we have a film called Triangle out this week, which is directed by Ringo Lam, Sui Ha, and Johnny To. How have these three great giants of Hong Kong cinema all directed the same film?
Well, I think this is, we've mentioned this, I think this might be a one-off, actually. This is slightly unique. They're basically playing a game of pass the parcel or relay through this film. So Hark starts out, then he passes the baton on to Ringo Lam, and then Ringo Lam passes the baton on to Johnny To, and it all gets kind of wrapped up at the end. So it's almost like a sort of Chinese Whispers kind of school of filmmaking. There you go. And it's again, I guess, like with Ozon, with the Ozon film, it's a neat conceit. It's a nice game. I think Hark actually really sort of causes a lot of problems here because he starts out, his introduction has so many kind of loose ends and subplots and things like that, that he's almost like playing a game where he's saying, right, now unpick that, Ringo. Yeah. And then Ringo's got to try and kind of unravel it all, and he drops some of the plot threads and just ditches some others, and some minor characters kind of disappear. And then Johnny To comes in at the end and kind of wraps it up.
I don't know how it worked. Do you think they told each other what they were going to do? Or they just said, I've done his 30 minutes, I've done it, watch that and see what you can do next.
I kind of hope this starts a trend because I would like to see more films like this, and with really ridiculous sort of combinations of directors.
So Loach passes to Lee. Yeah. Lee passes
no,
to...
No. You know, Ken Loach passes to, say, Michael Bay. You know, let's have that. And then B. Latar comes in at the end to sort of finish it off. And you could just have a complete sort of schizoid film going on.
I mean, I thought Johnny To was the best one right at the end.
Yeah, I guess so.
He did what Johnny To does, and there's some great set pieces. There is a really good kind of set piece where all the lights go out and they kind of shoot each other.
But isn't the third act always the advantage? Because you're basically, you know, you're wrapping it all up with a big gun battle.
Yeah.
That's great, and that's what Johnny To does.
Talking of On the Lam, Ringo Lam, these segs are coming like
you're like
a
regular
flies.
DJ.
On the Lam is Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek in Terrence Malick's Badlands, re-released for no particular reason, but then you don't need a reason to release Badlands, it seems to me. It's back at the BFI and touring the country, but not On the Lam.
One day, while taking a look at some vistas in Dad's stereopticon, it hit me that I was just this little girl, born in Texas, whose father was a sign painter, who had only just so many years to live. It sent a chill down my spine, and I thought, where would I be this very moment if Kid had never met me or killed anybody? This very moment.
I think this is one of my favourite films, actually.
Yeah, I knew it would be.
I think it's absolutely great. It's certainly Terrence Malick's best film. It's a lovers on the run crime story vaguely based on fact. I think, you know, most other films of this ilk either try to explain the motivations of its characters or romanticise them, and Malick doesn't. The characters are kind of a mystery. It's a very strange, lyrical, haunting film, and you never quite understand these people, and I guess by implication the sense is that America itself, or the American heartland, is slightly unmoored and drifting, and there's sort of violence bred in the blood. Really.
I think those 70s mavericks were always supposed to be tapping into a kind of unease because of Vietnam, and kind of the Watergate had left them adrift and politically uncertain. And Bonnie and Clyde kick things off, and this has kind of got sort of elements of Bonnie and Clyde's style. In fact, in the final credits, I noticed there's a sort of thanks to Arthur Penn. So you wouldn't have had this film without Bonnie and Clyde, and yet it is very different to that. It is kind of more poetic.
It's very poetic,
kind of existential and thoughtful.
Yeah, and it's got just superb performances from Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek, and particularly Sissy Spacek's kind of woozy, blasted voiceover. That she's basically our kind of tour guide through this strange world, and yet she's kind of untrustworthy herself.
Yeah,
she's
in a way,
going along for the ride.
Seeing it this week reminded me of Roma Legarai's kind of narrator, sort of untrustworthy narrator as well, because Sissy's kind of seeing it as some kind of almost Hollywood romance, seeing it as something from the magazines that she reads throughout the film.
And the film is like, it's like a sort of a Norman Rockwell or an Andrew Wyeth painting kind of gone wrong, that it's this sort of corn-fed, beautiful American kids basically gone bad, gone crazy. And yet not gone crazy in a kind of, you know, flamboyant way. They're just kind of like moseying around killing people.
And is it chilling? At the time people said, oh, this is kind of cold-blooded murder and that's frightening. Watching it again, I wasn't sort of put off by the murder. It seemed very sort of casual in its way.
Absolutely. It's casual and they're kind of polite and, you know, there's a sort of warmth to them, weirdly, in the way that they just want to be together and live, and just occasionally people get in the way and have to be shot.
I thought maybe Badlands might date. However, it actually seemed more personal perhaps than ever.
It's
of
kind
celebrity
of unique.
Culture.
I think it's one of those films that's been endlessly imitated since, and yet the actual core of it, nobody's come close to replicating. It's you know, an auteur's film. Nobody else could have made this film, and people have been trying for the last 30-odd years to make this film, and that no one's come close.
Two wonderful dance sequences in it. First to
Love is Strange.
By Mickey and Sheila, and then reprise Closer by When Nat King Cole's A Blossom Fell, and it's absolutely gorgeous, lit by the lights of their car in some kind of, in the Badlands, in the field of nowhere. The car's about to die, and just the battery left, and they just dance. And it's incredibly romantic.
I mean, it's one of those weird films that if it wasn't for all the inconvenient murders, this would be, you know, one of the great American love stories.
Badlands is on tour from this Friday, the 29th of August. And you can read Zan Brooks' insights into the cinematic arts by going to guardian.co.uk/film. Zan, thank you very much. The great and the good of the film world are gathering on the Lido in Venice. The Coen brothers' Burn After Reading is the opening night film. George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and the even more glamorous Andrew Pulver, editor of Guardian Film, are out there. Andrew, thanks for joining me on the line. What's the atmosphere in Venice like this year?
It seems pretty good. I mean, it's slightly hard to tell because it's only just started, but the Coen film screened this morning to the press, and everybody liked that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, because everyone's, obviously, this is their follow-up to No Country for Old Men. Are they still on Oscar-winning form?
They could be. This is a pretty straight comedy, pretty sunny stuff, very funny, knockabout fast, really, with lots of star names in it. It is about as different as it could be from No Country for Old Men. Oscars, they tend to like quite heavy, serious dramas. This isn't that.
Yeah, Brad Pitt, can he do comedy?
Certainly. Very, very funny. He isn't in the film that much, actually. I won't tell you why not, but he definitely has the smallest role of all the principal cast. But he is very funny. There's one or two bits that are in the trailer that people can see.
On
film are just as good.
Who's the lead? Is it George? Is it Francis McDormand?
They're sort of all co-leads, really. But I think it feels like George Clooney and Francis McDormand have the sort of two of the slightly bigger roles. John Malkovich has quite a large role, and Tilda Swinton also, but slightly smaller, I think.
So have you, I know you get to a film festival, you open up the guide and there's like 1,000 films bursting at you. Have you picked out any that you're looking forward to over the next 10 days?
I would say the ones I'm most looking forward to are, I like the look of Shirin, which we'll see tomorrow, which is the new film from Abbas Kiarostami. Nobody really knows much about it, but he's always interesting. There's the director of The View of Guillermo Arriaga, who's obviously famous for writing all those Alejandro González Iñárritu films like Amores Perros, but who rather spectacularly fell out with him last year, and now is taking up the cudgels on his own. So we'll have to see how he does.
So he's directing on his own, because he wrote Tommy Lee Jones's Burials of Thomas Melquiades as well.
Yeah. And I think the feeling was he got a bit sick of everybody else taking credit for what he considered his screenplay. So will he do a Charlie Kaufman and mess it up, or will he do something fantastic? That remains to be seen. His film's called The Burning Plain.
It does sound there's a lot to look forward to. Will you come back and tell us more? And we'll also be able to follow all your blogs and your coverage on guardian.co.uk/film.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Finally, on this edition of Film Weekly, we turn to the work of French director François Ozon. He of Swimming Pool, Eight Women and Five Times Two, whose subjects range from kitsch to cancer to bereavement and to murder. For his latest film, his ninth in 10 years, he turns to the work of English writer Elizabeth Taylor and adapts her work Angel for the big screen. Rising star Romola Garai gives a tour de force performance alongside one of the hottest British actors of the moment, Michael Fassbender. Let's hear the two of them in action in François Ozon's Angel.
Forgive the mess, but I've only just got out of bed. If I'd known a lady was coming, I'd have cleared some of this up.
Oh, you mustn't worry. I'm something of a bohemian myself.
How's my sister?
Nora is very well and very happy.
I can imagine. She's always had a gift for living in another person's shadow.
She certainly doesn't live in mine. I've always encouraged her to share in the brilliance of my success.
So, to what do I owe the pleasure of this visit?
I've come to see your paintings.
Really?
Well, since you were so cruel to me that time about the Watts, I thought I could make amends by having them hang one of your paintings next to it.
Well, they'd never let you. Anyway, I don't think you'd like my kind of work.
Well, that's what I'm here to find out.
François Ozon, welcome to Film Weekly here at The Observer. Thank you so much for joining us. Where do I find you? You're in France somewhere.
Yes, I'm in the southwest of France, in the Pays Basque.
Ah, and what are you doing
where
there?
Where there are many English. Many English.
Yes, there are. Well, they're trying to escape our terrible weather, which I'm sure you know very well, having tried to make a film here with Angel, which I think is an extraordinary production, François. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like Angel. You invent your world so often on film. This is your ninth film in 10 years. I mean, I think you've invented a whole new world here as well.
I think it comes from the world of the main character, Angel, because it's a story of a writer, and I try to be in her mind in the film. So all the world you see on screen is the world of Angel, and it comes from her imagination, a fantasy, and it's a very childish imagination.
It looks like sometimes the inside of a cake box.
She has very bad taste, like many children.
And I think that kind of style is very unusual to British cinema. Or was there a model in British film that you took? Because it seems to be a bit more Hollywood.
Yes, it was more Hollywood. For me, Angel was a Hollywood character in a very British context.
Setting, context, yep.
And I didn't want to be realist with her because she's not realist and she's not on her time. She lives in her dreams, in her world, and I wanted to make a big gap between these two realities. Everything is realist around her, but she's not realistic. And for me, it was a lot of fun for the costume, for the decoration, everything, because we had the freedom not to be exactly Edwardian time. You know,
it does look fantastic. I mean, I was loving the curtains, I was loving the bed sheets. You know? And I sometimes think maybe in a film that's bad, you know, if you're concentrating on the decor rather than the performance. But I think that they were so important in this film that you must have put a lot of work into that style.
It was a lot of work, but a lot of fun, because we were totally free to do what we wanted, you know. We used a red dress, which was totally unusual at this time. We used some furnitures in the house which didn't exist. We didn't try to be realistic, and sometimes the English crew was a little bit shocked by my choices. For example, in the church, you know, when the husband is dead, the coffer, you say?
The coffin, yeah.
and all the English says, it's impossible to have that in England. And I said, I don't care. It's Angel, you know. Angel does what she wants. She's like me, like a French director who works in England. He does what he wants. So we let the coffer open.
Is that what attracted you to this novel? Because I must say that Elizabeth Taylor, the novelist,
yes,
is not particularly known to me, although I did. There was another...
In France, she's famous. She's more famous in France than in England, I think.
Right, and I mean, it's for you to make this film, to make, yes, an English film, seems to me like Francois Ozon doing another genre. I mean, you've done Fassbinder, you've done your French country house musical, yeah, Murder, you've done sitcom, you've done your shorts, you've done your, you know, so many different kind of genres. It must be difficult for you to find another one to do each time.
I follow my taste, you know. I, as a cinephile, I can like some film of Bresson or action movie or musical. I have different tastes. So I don't try each time to make always the same thing. I try to go in new direction and to try different things.
Yes, it's interesting you say that, because for me as a critic, I have to accept all the genres that come towards,
yes,
me.
And I'm something close like to a critic. In this sense, I'm close to a critic.
Yes. Well, the French always were. The Cahiers du Cinéma, exactly. They all became directors. But it's,
yes,
I think it's difficult for audiences to kind of know what they're going to get with something like Angel.
But that is what is exciting, I think. Enfin, for me as an audience, I'm always excited to see a new film of someone I know, but I don't know exactly where he goes, you know. Each time I try to provoke or to give a surprise. Are there some audience who like to be surprised and some others want to see always the same thing? And now the cinema is very expensive. People want to be sure to see exactly what they want to see. In my case, it's more dangerous to see a film of François Ozon, maybe.
Yes, well, I think it always was. With sitcom was dangerous. This is dangerous because the rules have changed.
But people didn't know me when I did sitcoms. So
that's
it
true.
Was a problem.
They got to know you very quickly, I think.
Yes.
But I think with something like Angel, because you use back projections, there are, it,
yes,
seemed to me, it reminded me of Meet Me in St. Louis. It reminded,
yes,
me of Minelli films. It reminded me of Douglas Sirk melodramas, I suppose. It reminded,
yes,
me of many, many things.
Yes.
All the way along. Plus this
Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind, of course.
Yes.
And this wonderful performance from Romola Garry in between, who was everything between Judy Garland and Vivian Leigh and a
Bette
thousand
Davis.
Of the, and Bette Davis as well, yes. She sounds like a monster.
Yes. And Romola was very clever because she's very young when she did the film. And I met many other English actresses, and many actresses were afraid of the part. And she wasn't. She was very excited. And she loved the character of Angel. And I think she get the part when she told me, Angel is an actress. She's acting her life. You know, she's always in a representation.
Mm.
And I think at this moment, she had really the key of the character.
But, yes, but François, it was very interesting because to me, I was thinking, well, how many French directors have actually made films in the UK? And there's not many. I mean, I know René Clair did it in the 30s,
yes,
and of course, Truffaut did it in with Fahrenheit 451.
Desplechin did one.
And Desplechin did Esther Kahn, did he not?
Yes.
And I think recently Michel Blanc and Patrice Chéreau have made,
yes,
films. But
not, yes,
very, very, very few, considering. Do you have that relation? I mean, Truffaut always said that British and cinema were incompatible terms. Yes. But how did you find working here? How were we to you?
With the actors, it was a real dream because I thought the English actors were so professional, so clever, and they helped me so much, you know, because my English is so bad. They proposed me each time some things for the scenes, which was very helpful, you know, and very different of the French actors who very often don't know their text, you know. They come, they don't know the text, and they learn the text on the set, which is very boring. And
What's the film you're making now? What set are you on?
I finished a new film about a mother and her baby. And it's a very realistic movie with a lot of special effects, which is something totally new for me.
Yeah, I've not seen you do that.
And I'm just finishing, and I have some problems with the actors, as usual. But I'm finishing it.
Wouldn't filmmaking be easy if you didn't have to use actors?
Yes. It's always a nightmare, but I like that.
Yeah,
I don't know why.
Absolutely. And will you continue your work with actresses? Because, I mean, so many great parts for your Valerie.
I should, but sometimes I dream of animals, you know.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You'll become Luc Jacquet. You're going to make March of the Penguins and The Fox and the,
yes,
Child.
yes, The March of Penguins. It will be a good film for me.
Well, thank you very much for Angel as
well.
Thank
you to
you. It's a curio, I think, as well. Most curious film of the week here, and that's why we love it at Film Weekly. Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you.
And bon courage with more actresses.
Merci.
Au revoir.
À bientôt.
À bientôt. Au revoir. François Ozon there from the set of his latest film down in the south of France. I bet he's getting some decent weather. A grand merci to François Ozon there. And Angel is on release from this Friday, the 29th of August. Well, that's all we've got time for on Film Weekly this week. A big thanks to all my guests, to François Ozon, to Jonathan Levine, to Zan Brooks, and to Andrew Pulver out in Venice. I'm standing in for Philip French in The Observer this week, so you can read my long reviews of many of the films mentioned here in The Observer on Sunday. But from my producer, Jason Phipps, and from myself, Jason Solomons, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.